Pro Savings Days are back at Lowe's. My Lowe's Pro Rewards members save even more with limited-time doorbuster deals. Save $5 on 24-count Contractor's Choice 42-gallon trash bags, now just $14.78. Plus, get your choice select DeWalt Elite Series saw blades for $9.98. Not a Pro Rewards member? Join for free today at Lowe's. Valid through 9/17. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, loyalty programs subject to terms and conditions. See Lowe's.com/terms for details. Subject to change.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
In 1993 in Liverpool, two-year-old James Bulger was murdered by two other children in a crime that literally shook the nation, even to this day. But just 6 years later, in that same city, another child was killed in an equally horrific torture murder. The perpetrators, once again, just children themselves. The motive for the crime, unbelievable. The 15-year-old victim had been in a relationship with the ex-girlfriend of one of his killers. This is what happens when revenge turns deadly. This is the Reservoir Dogs murder.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen.
Let's start with today's case. Wow. Michael Moss. So Michael Moss had a really happy childhood growing up in Liverpool. He lived with his parents. He lived with his older sister. At the time of his childhood, he was really, really interested in all things mechanical. According to his mum, he wasn't necessarily very academic, but he could literally take something apart and reassemble them without a problem, which makes him a great more adept at these kind of things than somebody like myself. I can take things apart. The reassembling them is a very big problem. However, I can't even use my Apple remote, if I'm completely honest. But even though he wasn't academic, that doesn't mean we're not dealing with somebody who's very bright. And it kind of annoys me that very often we think about the academic system as a reality to intellect, and it's not. You know, if you are absolutely brilliant at certain skills, but it's not reflected in the education system, often you think you're stupid, but you're not stupid. The system is stupid. So he's growing up in almost an idyllic circumstance, apparently he loved to understand how things worked. And one of his favourite things was he loved to tinker with bikes. But as happens in life sometimes, an event unfolds that totally changes the course of his life. When he's just 11 years of age, his dad, Michael, who he was incredibly close to, died. Now, when you are 11 years of age, you are completely aware of the world around you. You have your primary relationships. You value the role models in your life. And when those individuals disappear, in this case through death, it is massively traumatic. And understandably, the world feels unsafe. You feel vulnerable. But also, how do you manage those feelings? The truth is that children are often, and this is not being negative towards the other caregiver or the people in their lives, they're dealing with their own grief. And when you are dealing with your own grief, you are consumed by it. And that means that you have very little energy to be able to help others manage their grief. And often children fall by the wayside in these circumstances because everyone just thinks that they'll get on with it. I hear it consistently, oh, children are resilient, they cope with these things. I used to work in schools and I used to go in and educate people on things like grief. And when a child loses somebody of pivotal importance in their life, the worst thing you can do is just get them back in school the next day, expect them to just carry on. They seem to be functioning, but actually they're massively overwhelmed. So their brain kind of shuts down and they incrementally have to deal with those feelings. And it can be incredibly abandoning, incredibly isolating. And for Michael, it would have been. So it has this huge impact on him. And for some kids, that might make them withdraw. From some kids, it might make them super needy. For some kids, you might see regression behaviors such as bedwetting. For some children, they will be angry because it's the most visceral and cerebral experience to connect with that sense of, I feel angry. And then if you feel angry and you act on that anger, what will happen is it will manifest in a change in the way that you behave in social settings and educational settings. And this is what happens for him, and it sends him off the rails. But even though that's playing out as him being deeply disruptive at school, he should have been met with sympathy and empathy. I have a real problem that when a kid who's gone through such a traumatic life event ends up being dysfunctional in their behavior, that the consequences are that they get excluded. But that's what happens. He's excluded from his mainstream provider, and that means he has to start a pupil referral unit. And that pupil referral unit is basically for students with special educational needs. I used to run a pupil referral unit for kids who'd failed in pupil referral units. So I actually had the kids who even the PRUs couldn't manage. And it was very rare for me not to be able to identify their life experiences as being pivotal in their behaviors. Often it was trauma-based, and they had been punished for dealing with some of the most incompatible feelings with childhood that we could ever expect to note. They were victims. They were not perpetrators of negativity. And for me, Michael should not have been excluded. I'm sure his behavior was really bad, but he had lost his dad and he didn't know how to manage it, and he was angry. His mum, she's dealing with her own grief. She's going through the motions of managing her family life whilst also dealing with the void that's been created by the loss of her partner and the chasm of grief that that involves. So Michael's behavior is obviously going to be problematic for her. She doesn't need any more problems added to those that are already existing. So she needs respite from time to time. And in the end, that respite results in Michael being made the subject of a care order. And what happens in the UK with a care order, in particular referring to this case, is that it meant that he went and lived at a local authority centre. Children in care do not fare well, I will be honest with you. Some children manage to overcome the odds, but there are huge impacts emotionally, socially, psychologically, and actually criminally often when kids enter the care system. So the statistics of a child going into care and then ending up with a criminal record are through the roof. The same when it comes down to a lack of academic attainment. When kids go into care, particularly when we're looking at the teenage years, and they are at a statutory care unit or a private care unit, they essentially are far more likely to fail in academia. So we have this cumulative effect of problematic realities when this occurs. And no child wants to find themselves in a scenario where when the door is closed at night, there is nobody in that household who actually physically belongs to them. Because the truth is, you are there with care workers as opposed to family members. And I think that can be incredibly isolating and abandoning and would compound his grief. Equally, I have sympathy and empathy for a parent who can't cope anymore because of her own issues and because she's going through some of the most horrible experiences dealing with the loss that she's incurred of losing a partner. Now, during his time at the pupil referral unit, Michael meets three other students. This is in 1999. So he meets 15-year-old Alan Bentley, Mark McCaffrey, and 16-year-old Graham Neary. Michael became really good friends with Bentley, but he was also friendly with McCaffrey, but he didn't know Neary very well. But I would say these three lads were kind of known archetypally in the area as being quite big bullies. Bentley and McCaffrey had actually been expelled from Lidland High School, and the reason for that expulsion was a ferocious attack on another student. So violence is something they are adept at using. They had punched this student to the ground and they kicked this student, and it had been a really big group attack. And his injuries were so severe that he'd actually been hospitalized. So I would argue at this point, these individuals definitely have a predisposition for violence, and they're actually quite content to use that kind of violence against others. Now, the relationship between Michael and Bentley, it alters. The reason for this is that Bentley has a girlfriend. He splits up with that girlfriend in October 1999. So he's the one who ends the relationship with this particular girl. but shortly after Michael starts seeing her. I mean, this is just commonplace, isn't it? We've all been in situations where our friends have ended up dating one of our exes when we were a kid because it's no big deal. But of course, reputationally, this can cause issues, particularly with individuals who might have more narcissistic tendencies. They're people who like the world to work in the way that they wish the world to work. And when somebody deviates from that plan...
Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Dutch Boy's DuraFighter is an interior paint and primer in one with a tough-lasting formula. It provides great scrub resistance and durability with remarkable hide and a smooth finish. Save big on Dutch Boy's DuraFighter paint at Menards and start your next project today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at
Menards. Lowe's knows how to help make your home holiday ready for less. Get Select Style Selections vinyl flooring for just $1.99 per square foot and have it installed before the festivities begin. Our team can help you every step of the way. See a Lowe's Red Vest associate or visit lowes.com/holiday install to get started. Lowe's, we help, you save. Basic install only. Date restrictions apply. Subject to availability. Install by independent contractor. See associate for details. Contiguous US only.
And they're unhappy. And it seems that Bentley is really not accepting or happy about the fact that his friend is now seeing his ex. And he gets fueled by this feeling of needing revenge. And he actually mentions to a friend that he wants to kill Michael and boot his head in. Now, we can all agree, kids talk a lot of shit about the way that they want to do things and what they plan to do at times, but we're talking about somebody who has form. And also the fact that he's saying boot his head in, again, it's a term of phrase, but we have seen that this is exactly what this young person has done before to another victim. In fact, he's obviously got into trouble for doing it to that victim. So this is an individual who has a history of violence. And it's not enough to just talk about it and to vent. It seems that he starts pretty immediately to devise a plan where he can get Michael alone and vulnerable. And he's clever because he knows that Michael is pretty obsessed with his love of bikes. And so he uses that knowledge to his advantage. So we get to the 12th of November, 1999. Now, Bentley, at this point, has had a birthday celebration at his home. A number of people had come to join the party. This includes McKeefrey, Neary, and another teenager, Neil Breslin. And during this kind of get-together and party, a bottle of vodka and also some cider had been drunk. So we're talking quite high levels of alcohol. And again, Bentley starts to speak about wanting to beat up Michael because he says that Michael's had sex with his former girlfriend. It makes no sense whatsoever. Michael can have sex with his ex-girlfriend because they are exes. But it's really riling Bentley up. It really is annoying him. And now he's inebriated and he has, shall we say, pack mentality around him. People who can give him permission base for these kind of vile actions. So we get to approximately 1 a.m., 13th November 1999. Bentley makes a phone call to Michael. This is at Michael's care home where Michael's living at the time. And he says, I want you to meet me in an alleyway. And this alleyway is an alleyway that leads to Moss Park in Litherland, and it's on the outskirts of Liverpool. And the reason that he wants him to go and meet him is he says, look, I've got a bike that I want to show you. Now, bear in mind, Michael is pretty obsessed with bikes and he really couldn't resist. So he takes the bait. But also, Michael may have had problematic behaviours. Yes, he may have been sent to a PRU. Yes, he is an individual who is showing behavioural dysfunction, but he is not violent in the way that the boys that I've talked about so far are. So he is not thinking, I need to be scared of these guys because they had been friends. And yes, there have been some fractures in that friendship, but he's probably just thinking, brilliant, Bentley's on the phone to me, he's my mate again. Hopefully we're going to move forward and past whatever problems that we've got. And I want to go and see that bike. So he would be completely naive to what's about to play out. And my God, he would be naive because what plays out is just absolutely grotesque. He leaves his care home around 1:20 a.m., which is ridiculous. Why are we talking about care home when a child of his age can go out at 1:20 a.m. And I do appreciate, for those of you who are care workers in the UK, I know how difficult it is to prevent kids leaving. I get it. I know that the legal framework is very much geared towards the child and not towards the care workers. And if you cross certain boundaries, there can be problems for you. But no, 1:20 a.m, no child should be leaving a care home to go and see friends, because we can see that that's problematic on a whole heap of levels. You know, we're meant to be protecting and caring and safeguarding these kids, and he shouldn't be leaving at that point. And unfortunately, this journey that he takes, it's going to be the last one that he ever does. He's never going to return. Because when Michael meets up with Bentley, what he didn't realise was McKeefrey and Breslin were going to be with him. So at this point, the group, they all walk to the park. This is, of course, as planned. But there's no bike for Michael to see. And I wonder at what point Michael got that sinking feeling in his stomach, which I absolutely 100% believe he would have had. Because once they get in the park, once they're fully out of sight of the public, Michael, literally without warning, was subjected to the most horrific, sustained and brutal assault. It begins when Bentley, out of nowhere, just headbutts him. Michael's not prepared. Instantly, he's knocked to the floor, probably reeling in shock. What's happened? Why have you just done that? The pain hitting him, the fear overcoming him. Then he and McKeefrey just begin to repeatedly punch him, to kick him. And Breslin at this point, by the way, decides that he doesn't want to be part of it. He walks away whilst the attack continues. He's not got the stomach for this. Apparently, he also allegedly unsuccessfully tried to pull McKeefrey off Michael, but he didn't get help for him. And that is a massive, grave error, because his instinct that something terrible is playing out here and ideally needs to be stopped is the correct instinct. So he walks away, leaving him without help. And he leaves him at the mercy of these two violent, intentful attackers. McKeefrey humiliates Michael. He strips off his clothing except for his socks. That's power play domination. It creates this vulnerability in Michael. It's demasculating for him. And he'll know that psychologically. He throws his clothes in a puddle. Michael's just lying defenseless, injured on the ground. And then he begins to jump onto his head with both feet. I'm sure that for everyone listening to this, we all know how incalculably devastating that kind of injury will be. That's who we are. It's where we are. We focus in our brain. To have somebody jumping full force with both their feet on our head, problems that it's going to incur for us are just grave beyond belief. And whilst the human body can manage a great deal, I mean, the human body is incredible. We have seen people injured in the most horrific of circumstances survive and thrive. But having somebody consistently jump on your head with both feet, you're not going to be walking away from that. At best, you're going to be horrifically injured, probably debilitated for the rest of your life. And at worst, it's going to end your life. They also believe that at some point he probably climbed up onto a climbing frame where he repeatedly jumped around 6 feet onto Michael's head. Just let that sink in. The premeditation, the action of doing that, the repeating of that behavior. By this point, Michael will have been critically injured, but instead of those boys coming to their senses and getting him help, Bentley, McKeefrey and Breslin just leave him alone in the park. This boy's naked, unconscious, bleeding on a cold November night. They then return to Bentley's house. They're excited, proud of what they've done. And Neary is actually at the house. He'd been there the whole time. And they tell Neary how they've stripped and battered Michael. And they're excited by this. And as they talk about it and pump each other's excitement and validate each other's permission, they realise they haven't finished with him just yet. So they return to the park, and this time, Neri came with them because he was keen to join in for the fun. That's the quote. To join in for their fun. He wanted a part of it. They arrive back at that park about 45 minutes later. McKeithry then points out that Michael's still alive. Yeah, he's still alive. But he's too injured to even move. In fact, he was literally lay where they had left him. This is how dire his injuries are. Now, of course, when it comes down to the reports to the police within their interviews, there are differing accounts about what happened next. I mean, each obviously is going to try to lay blame at the other people's feet, and that's what happens. But based on what they all disclosed and drawing out what the police believe happened and the injuries that Michael sustained, it is, I would say, quite possible to draw out a pretty accurate picture of what transpired. So the first attack, we know that was brutal beyond belief. I mean, jumping 6 foot repeatedly off a children's climbing frame onto somebody's head with both your feet, it's unbelievably brutal and grotesque. But incredibly, in spite of that seeming like such a high level of violence, they managed to escalate it even further. So according to Neri, McKeithry goes up to Michael and says to him, get up, threatens to smash him in the face if he doesn't get up. Now, Michael at this point obviously knows that firstly, he's likely mortally wounded to some degree. I'm sure that the terror and fear was just coursing through his veins. And of course, he knows what these individuals are capable of. So he's going to try to follow that kind of command because the consequences are going to be even worse for him if he fails to do what they're asking. So he tries desperately to get to his feet, but he can't. The injuries that he sustained.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Are already so life-threatening that he can't walk. Immediately falls back to the ground. Now, McKeithry, he would later claim that it was Neri who was the first one that resumed the assault. And he said that Neri kicked Michael in the head. But once it began, it's like that pack mentality absolutely takes over. And all three of them just start to repeatedly punch and kick and stamp on Michael's head and body. Now, according to McKeithry, it was Neri who really went for it. He repeatedly kicked Michael in the face with the back of his heel. So just imagine that, the force of the back of your heel going into this kid's face. And then, horrifically, they decided to have a game of penalties with his head. So they were joking at the time that they were the footballer Michael Owen. So basically, they line him up on the floor, take a run up, and then they repeatedly kick him as hard as they could in the head and the face. They also took turns repeatedly kicking him between the legs, stamping on his genitals. The dehumanization level that we're talking about here is absolutely off the charts. They know he's not going to walk away from this, and they have no intention of letting him walk away from this. But my God, they're enjoying the time that they have with him. They want to really have the opportunity to fully destroy, to fully execute this innocent young man. And we can't help not noting the fact that earlier on in the evening they'd actually been watching the 1992 Quentin Tarantino film Reservoir Dogs, which I'm sure the vast majority of you have seen. Now, in this particular film, there's a really infamous scene, and this is during when the character Mr. Blonde tortures a police officer. And he's torturing this police officer and he's dancing around the room to a song, Stuck in the Middle with You. And during this scenario, he basically slices off the officer's ear with a razor blade. Now, McKeefry uses this as an inspiration and he decides that it would be a lot of fun to recreate it. Bear in mind what I've just told you about how absolutely destroyed this young boy's body has already been. And McKeefry is just additionalizing it with torturous opportunity. Now, they've been drinking and they actually have with them an empty bottle of vodka. So Bentley smashes it. Then whilst dancing and singing the exact same song, McKeefry attempts to sever Michael's ear with the broken bottle. And then when he's created these horrible wounds that additionalize the intense agony this young person has been going through, they pour cider into his open wounds. Then they use the broken glass to take turns stabbing Michael all over his body. They even scratched a game of noughts and crosses into his back. In total, that young boy was subjected to a vicious, sustained assault. It lasted over a period of 2 hours. He never stood a chance. There was never an opportunity for him to defend himself. And for the last 10 minutes of that brutality, apparently he didn't move, he didn't make a sound. It's more likely that, at that point, he was already dead. But that's not enough to stop the attack. They finally finished their assault on Michael. And just for good measure, according to Neary, McKeefry gave him one last kick to the head. And then the trio leave his battered body just lying, naked, broken, bleeding in the park. Now later, McKeefry calls an ambulance. This is about 3:31 a.m. But he was really imprecise about where they'd be able to find Michael's body. And they actually terminated the call partway through. Not that it mattered anymore. It was already far too late for emergency services to make a difference to this situation. Now, emergency services, with respect, they did actually try to go and locate Michael, but they hadn't been given enough details and the proper details of where his location was. So he was unable to be found at that point. And they kind of thought, well, maybe, you know, thinking about the age of the caller, thinking about them cutting off the call halfway through, the likelihood is that it was probably a 999 hoax. Now, it's later claimed that what actually happened is they called for the ambulance, but then the killers got cold feet and they moved Michael's body so that the paramedics wouldn't find him. Now, in retrospect, it would have made absolutely no difference to the result, but it could be that they had started to think, oh my God, what if he isn't dead? We need to make sure that they don't find him just in case he talks and tells them what we've done. The truth is, there was absolutely no hope that he would have ever survived. I mean, he was dead before the second attack even ended. But you can imagine in their childish brains, so to speak, that's what they're considering, save ourselves rather than save him. We get to the 13th of November, 1999. This is about 7:30 a.m. in the morning, and a man is walking his dog in the playing fields. And at this point, he very sadly discovers Michael's battered, naked body. It's on the grass near Liveland Moss Primary School. When this guy found him, he could see that this person was all but unrecognizable. He was so mutilated by his injuries. And when the police were later handed a picture of Michael to identify him as the possible victim, they couldn't tell whether it was him or not. They genuinely couldn't look at his features and compare that picture of this young boy with this mutilated mess of a human body. Now, he was later formally identified by a member of staff from his care home. And of course, we have Michael's mother. She's lost her husband. She's lost her stability. She's lost her son living with her because of his behaviour and reaction to the trauma that he's experienced. And now she's handed this tragic news that her boy's never going to come home again. And I imagine she must have felt guilt because she would feel somehow that she was culpable in this situation, that he'd been in care, that if he had been with her, it would never have happened. All the if, what's and buts and whys. But she's an innocent party in this scenario, and she's now dealing with this dual trauma of the losses that so few of us can ever even imagine happening to us. Apparently she became utterly hysterical. She was angry. She was in disbelief. And she refused to accept that her son was dead. She refused to acknowledge it. She didn't want to hear it. And according to the police, she did everything that she could to not hear that news. Apparently, during the years that followed his death, she went on to suffer a mental breakdown. She had hospitalizations. She was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder and superimposed depression. She is yet another enormous victim who's had her safety and her life stolen because of the catastrophic impact of these reprehensible actions. Now, as soon as Michael's body is found, a murder investigation was launched, and on account of what transpired in interviews, it was dubbed in the press the Reservoir Dogs murder. But let me tell you, police wouldn't have to wait very long at all for the perpetrators to be identified, because later the same afternoon that the body's found, McKeefrey and Bentley basically brag to McKeefrey's girlfriend Emma Farrell about the attack. They describe punching Michael in his face, kicking him in his privates, but they do fail to tell her about the actual truth of their brutality, because obviously this is about Michael being murdered. This isn't just about him being beaten up. And it speaks volumes, doesn't it, about their mindset, because there is a level of pride, isn't there? The fact that they want to tell people about what they have done. Michael has been brutalized to such a degree he is now dead, unrecognizable. A murder investigation has begun, and yet they are talking about these actions with a fever and with a pride. They are violent to their core. Now, when Neary actually hears that Michael had died from his injuries, what I would say is that he's essentially overcome with guilt. I mean, we can say better late than never, can't we, where this is concerned? But there is something about realizing that this is about a person losing their life that really affects him. And he confesses to his mother, and then he subsequently speaks to the police, and he reports the part that he'd actually played in Michael's death. And because he speaks to the police, and because no doubt his mother has advised him appropriately, he also gives up the names of his accomplices, Bentley and McKeefrey. Now, all three of them were subsequently arrested on suspicion of murder. And of course, how do they manage this situation? Well, as we see time and time again, they just start to blame one another for the killing. It's not my fault. It's his fault. It's not his fault. It's his fault. It's not my fault. It's their fault. They're the perpetrators, and so on and so forth. This is how it is. And again, this is not to say that that is a childish, naive way of managing this scenario. We see this consistently.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
directly with perpetrators, whether they are 15 or 55, the easiest way is to deflect suspicion from yourself and to project that suspicion onto somebody else. So they start to try to mitigate their role in it. Now, one of the most absurd claims from the defendants was that Michael, the victim, had planned the attack himself. So yeah, one of the defendants basically says, Michael wanted this. And you can imagine, got you in the interview. So just run that past me again. Okay, so what I'm saying is that Michael, he wanted that attack to happen. Michael wanted to be murdered. No, Michael didn't want to be murdered. It wasn't meant to be murder. Didn't you jump off a climbing frame with both feet on his head, line him up and pretend you're Michael Owen whilst kicking him in the head, use a vodka bottle that was smashed to stab him all over his body, reenacting a scene from a film whilst singing that scene from a film? Allegedly, yeah, but what I'm saying is Michael wanted it. Michael wanted to be murdered. No, that's where it's all gone a bit topsy-turvy, but you know accidents happen. What I'm saying is he wanted it because he wanted to get beaten up to claim criminal injuries. So he created this whole scenario where he died so he could claim criminal injuries. That's exactly it. Why did he die? Well, that's the problem. When you come up with a plan like that and you haven't thought it through, these kind of mistakes can occur. You do realise that no one's going to believe this. In the back of my mind, I do have an idea that no one's going to believe it. But at the same time, I think maybe some idiots are involved in the criminal justice system. And maybe I'll be lucky enough to get a few of those on the jury. And, I don't know, in the defence team, trying to use that as some kind of weird get-out clause. I kid you not. Yeah, apparently Michael just wanted some criminal injuries compensation. So was quite happy to have his head kicked in, be stabbed all over his body, have his genitals crushed, and so on and so forth. So the extent of the injuries that I've talked about obviously showed that that is absolute BS. It's totally untrue. Neary, he claims that he hadn't actually wanted to hurt Michael after returning with Bentley and McKeefry to the park, and that he only kicked Michael a few times because he didn't want to get on the wrong side of those boys. And he also said that he didn't kick him anywhere where it would have caused a serious injury. Arguably, it's the easiest way forward, isn't it? I'm culpable, but not that culpable. And again, it doesn't tend to wash with investigators. Chain of causation, you were there. You've acted in a way that's reprehensible and somebody has died. And no one can say definitely or otherwise that what you're saying is true. So you are bang to rights in that circumstance. McKeefry, well, they give a completely different version of events. So in his account, Neary was an active and very willing participant and he didn't need any encouragement whatsoever. When they examine the clothes of all three of them, it implicates all three of them without a doubt. So they had really heavy blood staining on their footwear, on their socks, on their trousers, even their tops. In fact, the blood was even ingrained into the stitching and crevices of the trainers, because basically they were kicking him when he was bleeding and they soaked into those crevices. Also, there were patterns on Michael's body and groin area and they matched the pattern on the soles of their trainers. So I don't buy in for 1 minute that there was one individual going harder than the others. I think they were all equally involved. Now, during a subsequent search of Bentley's room, police actually found drawings that he'd made of a teenager being bludgeoned with hammers. So he's got murder on his mind, hasn't he? There is something really dysfunctional and broken going on within his psyche. And the fact that he's drawing those out, it's not art therapy, is what I'm saying. It's not art therapy. It's more this individual has malevolence running through his veins. And the rage in the local area was so enormous because of what happened to Michael that after the murder, gangs actually drove Bentley's mother from her council house. Now, of course, Bentley's mother is not to blame in this circumstance. We can all agree that. But that is how people were feeling emotionally. They were like, we don't want a murderous mother on our estate. Now, there is an enormous amount of evidence against these young men. Of course there is. And in spite of that, Bentley, McKeefrey and Neary pleaded not guilty to the murder charge. I know. It's never a surprise in these situations, is it? Are you sure that you are not guilty? Absolutely sure. It was for criminal injuries compensation. I don't think that one's going to work. Okay, I'm just going to go for I'm not guilty on the bland, banal hope that somebody will believe me. But no one's going to believe you, and I'm literally your defence barrister, and I just think you should say that you're guilty, because clearly that will be impactful on your sentence. I know you think that you know everything, because what, you are a qualified individual of the cloth and law, but I'm saying that I think I'm brighter than you, and I'm manipulative enough to get away with this. But so far, you haven't got away with anything, have you? You didn't even get away with a mainstream education because you got excluded. I'm not fancying your chances in court. I know, but I'm just going to stick with it. I'm going to go not guilty, and I'm going to blame all the others for the actions that happened, even though it was all over my clothes and evidentially on my shoes that I had aggressed this person. I'm going to go and think about a new career after this case is what I'm going to do. But basically, that's what they do. Not guilty to the murder charge. Now, a post-mortem happened on the 13th of November 1999, and that established the injuries that were just absolutely harrowing. Michael had endured more than 100 separate injuries. His skull had basically been shattered. He had fractures to his cheekbones. They extended into the eye sockets. His nose had completely separated from the skull. Like, these injuries have probably been caused by kicking, stamping, punching, or that jumping from a height. They would have blocked his airways, and that was probably enough to prove fatal. But there were many, many, many more injuries than that. He had 10 broken ribs. He had a break in the cervical vertebrae, that's a bone in the neck, and that had been caused by really forceful kicks to the back and side of the head. His head and his body was literally black and blue. It was just extensive bruising all the way through. He'd been stabbed at least 48 times. Now, none of those stab wounds alone would have proved fatal, but the number of them, the sheer number of them, could potentially have caused a fatal loss of blood on their own. There was also a really deep wound between his ear and scalp. That was where there'd been the attempt to basically slice his ear off. And it was estimated that there had been at least 60 stamps and kicks to cause the multiple injuries. There was also this really extensive bruising in the groin area. And they said that to cause that kind of bruising in that area, the degree of force applied would have been considerable. 4 or 5 on a scale of 1 to 5. So basically what we're saying there is somebody would have kicked him as forcefully as you could kick or stamp. It's as simple as that. And as I said, when they were looking at the footmarks, one of the things about the footwear marks was they'd actually found them on his genitals. Now, from the nature of some of the stab wounds inflicted, it was also possible to conclude that Michael had actually died sometime before the second attack had ended. I mean, that's not merciful release. This kid had gone through the most barbaric killing. It's unbelievable to imagine the pain that he endured. I kind of hope that he was so concussed, so confused, and eventually so unconscious that maybe he wasn't awake for that second attack, at least not for much of it. I can only hope. I've got no evidence for that, but it just breaks my heart to imagine that young boy was left in that park naked, alone, terrified, and so badly injured that it caused his death. We get to the 26th of July 2000. There's a 16-day trial in the Liverpool Crown Court, and there's a 16 hours deliberation. There's a jury of 5 women, 2 men, and they find all 3 defendants guilty of murder. So those not guilty, please go unheard. Bentley and McKeefrey were unanimously found guilty, and there was a 10-2 majority verdict reached in Neary's case. So not everybody was as convinced about Neary's guilt as they were about Bentley and McKeefrey's. Bentley and McKeefrey were both sentenced to life, but wait for it, that life is only a minimum term of 10 years, which for the kind of attack I've just described seems to be ludicrous. Also, they show absolutely no emotion when they're sentenced. Neary was also sentenced, but he was given 9 years. and he apparently cried as the sentence was passed. When the sentence was passed, Judge Mr. Justice Penry Davy stated this: "You, Bentley and McKeefrey, lured Michael Moss out on that night. You stripped him naked, and in due course, the three of you killed him. Having attacked and injured him so that he was unable to move, you left him, and later the three of you went to the scene where the appalling violence continued. As a result of that attack, Michael Moss sustained appalling multiple injuries, internally and externally, as a result of which he died." After the hearing, Michael's poor mother, Liz, told reporters this: "Their parents still have their sons. My son is dead. They can see them get married. All we have is the grave. I cannot believe how three of Michael's so-called friends could do that to him. I feel they are evil and psychotic. I still have nightmares about it. I will never come to terms with it, but I will have to learn to live with it. We now want to be left in peace to get on with our lives." She's right, isn't she? They'll walk the streets again, potentially have a family, potentially injure the world further because of their violent dispositions. And her son, he doesn't get to do anything, not even to breed again. Neil Breslin, he's another one of the individuals involved in this. He actually pleaded guilty to violent disorder in respect of that very first attack on Michael, because he admitted that he was present during part of the first attack. But he said, "I wasn't involved. I wasn't present for the subsequent attack on Michael, and I didn't want to be involved in what happened at all." Now, he had already served 7.5 months in custody. So at the point where he was tried, he was sentenced to a 2-year supervision order. Some of you might think that's acceptable. Some of you might find it absolutely lackluster. I would say that I do have an understanding as to why they decided to give him that particular sentencing as opposed to keep him incarcerated. It seems he certainly didn't have the stomach for killing, and he certainly didn't want to be involved, but he failed Michael by not sending for help. Everything could have been averted in this circumstance if he had actually called an ambulance or the police. But again, a lot of people will have sympathy and empathy with a young man who doesn't want to find himself in the face of this kind of attack, and may well have believed that that could have been a possibility if he'd said anything. That snitches get stitches is certainly something that a lot of young people hold true to. Now, during his incarceration, Bentley unbelievably and allegedly threatens a woman who testified against him at his trial. Apparently sent her a message on Facebook. Police, in response to this, just advise her to ignore it. Just ignore it. "I've been sent a threatening message by a perpetrator who's murdered an individual in the most brutal of..."
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Lowe's knows how to help make your home holiday ready for less. Get Select Style Selections vinyl flooring for just $1.99 per square foot and have it installed before the festivities begin. Our team can help you every step of the way. See a Lowe's Red Vest associate or visit lowes.com/holiday install to get started. Lowe's, we help you save. Basic install only. Date restrictions apply. Subject to availability. Install by independent contractor. See associate for details. Contiguous US only.
Ways. Just ignore it. I feel that I don't need to ignore it. I feel like you, the police, should want to act on this because there is a violent perpetrator who feels, firstly, able to threaten me even though he's incarcerated, and secondly, has form that suggests he could harm me. We're just saying ignore it. Don't worry about it. Nothing to see here. Get on with your life. I kid you not. This woman was terrified, but no further action was taken against this violent murderer as a result of this. Great work there. That makes us feel really safe and protected, doesn't it? that a murderer can threaten you from incarceration and the response is, ah, don't stress, it'll all be fine. These things are not fine, and that should have been added to his record and probably criminally prosecuted so that he got more years on his sentence. Because isn't it about protecting the public? Isn't it about a recognition of the actions of these kind of perpetrators and the danger that they actually present to people like you and me? In 2006, Michael's mother, Liz Moss, actually confronted one of her killers for the first time when Neary applied for parole. She was actually told, bizarrely, in my opinion, that she wasn't allowed to speak during the proceedings, but she just couldn't help herself. And I have total empathy with that. I mean, I think they would have to tie me down, genuinely, if we're talking about the kind of brutality that my child would experience and endured and died from. I think I would literally have to be in a cage, like in the Hannibal movies, where they literally have to wheel me in with everything constricted so that I can't do desperate damage to the individuals who've stolen my child. But she manages to contain herself for the most part, but then does actually say during the hearing, "You still can't look at me, can you?" Neary was actually released in 2008 after serving just 9 years. He was 25. And in 2009, Liz came face to face with him for the first time. This is when he applied to move from his Category C facility into an open prison. At this point, she was allowed to read out a statement, and that statement detailed how the murder of her son had impacted her life. And you know, you just hope that her words have stained his conscience so that it's changed who he is, so that he's realised the gravity of his actions, so that he won't go on to continue being the bastard that he clearly was. Bentley was actually the last to be released on parole in 2012. He served 13 years. He was released on licence, and part of that licence was on condition that he didn't return to Merseyside. At his hearing, Liz submitted a victim impact statement. It read, "Every day of my life, I have flashbacks of what happened to Michael. I feel I cannot go outside my door because I am terrified to even look at things and places that remind me of what happened, which heightens the torture in my mind. I cannot go past the park or playing fields as I see the images of my beautiful son being tortured. What I see is Michael lying naked on a very cold November night with every part of his body bleeding and mutilated. I go into a trance and cannot hear people talking, but I can hear Michael shouting, 'Mum, Mum, Mum.' I also have a phobia of hearing breaking glass. I start to shake uncontrollably. I imagine I can feel the carving in my body that Michael felt. Sometimes I feel I'm losing my mind because I want to feel the torture he went through." Bentley has served a relatively short time in prison compared to my life sentence of grief and pain. And I absolutely relate to every single painful, striking word of what Michael's mother's saying there. She carries that pain every single second of every single day. Every atom in her body feels it. Even her desire to know the pain her child suffered so she can connect with him in that way. How dare they have done that to her? How dare they have stolen her son from her in such a horrific way? Michael's mother obviously spent years lobbying to keep all three of those perpetrators behind bars, but they've long since been released from prison on license. They served their minimum terms. They were still young men with their whole life in front of them, their whole life afforded them. Marriage, families, friendships, jobs, a life walking free, breathing in the air, living freely as individuals who can do whatever they choose to do with their lives. Whereas Michael's future was stolen in the most brutal of ways. And for what reason? For what reason? Just daring to go out with the ex-girlfriend of one of his murderous killers. It is breathtaking, absolutely blindsiding, that that event was used as a motivation to literally destroy this young man. And I don't know how you feel about the years that were given minimum sentence-wise to these individuals, but I will tell you personally, I do believe that young people change, and I do believe that keeping young people in prison for the rest of their natural lives is probably not the best way forward. But my God, do I believe that a decade, do I believe that 9 years is enough to educate somebody about the absolute impact of murder, torture, brutalization at the degree I've just described in this case? Do I feel that that is something that really teaches the lessons that are required? No. And the thing about psychopathy, let's say that 2 out of 3 were psychopaths. Well, they just spend most of their time incarcerated learning to be an even better psychopath than they were before. So actually, they could have come out and become more schooled, more adept in manipulation and aggression and hostility than they were prior to entering the system. Like I said, I don't feel that we should lock kids up forever. I do believe in second chances. But the time frame that these individuals served, it does not seem reflective of the crime they carried out. Michael's whole life was stolen. His mother's life has been stolen. And the consequences are grave for everybody who knew and loved him. And yet these individuals can just skip on their merry way, living their lives that they have been given back by a system that really should be there to protect you and I. I'd love to know your thoughts on this. Do you feel, like me, that there is leniency here that was not required? Do you feel that they should have been given this second chance and it's the right sentence length? Or does it disturb you to imagine that Michael's life was ended in such a despicable way and these individuals have been allowed to continue living their lives for the rest of their lives without really having to take the responsibility level we would expect to see when we're talking about a crime of this magnitude?
That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams, whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Lowe's knows how to help make your home holiday ready for less. Get Select Style Selections vinyl flooring for just $1.99 per square foot and have it installed before the festivities begin. Our team can help you every step of the way. See a Lowe's Red Vest associate or visit lowes.com/holidayinstall to get started. Lowe's, we help you save. Basic install only. Date restrictions apply. Subject to availability. Install by independent contractor. See associate for details. Contiguous U.S. only.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams, whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.